Welcome to the TTPOA Podcast, a podcast for SWAT officers, military, and all first responders. We'll be talking training, tactics, and leadership with the best subject matter experts around. Here are your hosts, Derek and Brandon.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome to the TTPOA Podcast. Excuse me. Brandon, I don't even know what episode we're on, man. I'm so lost and confused. I've been running around this competition trying to do stuff. And
you've been driving around.
I've been driving around doing stuff. I know, dude, but I don't even know what episode we're on, but I do know it's season two.
It is season two.
Right? It's season two. And our next guest, we were trying to get on
Season one,
one of the very first podcasts that we did. Yep. Unfortunately, he's a busy, important man, and he couldn't make his schedule. Or his publicist, his agent, whoever we talked
to, publicist.
Yeah, they couldn't work it out.
Channels to have to go through.
Yeah, we couldn't get it worked out for him to be on. But hey, right now he drove 2 hours to get here. Yeah. Right, so we're talking
uphill
to
in the snow,
uphill in the snow both ways. Yeah, yep. So we're talking to Sandy Wall.
Legend.
He is a legend, a TTPOA legend, a Houston SWAT legend. What else are you legendary for?
Is that a sexual prodification, but I don't want to talk about
that. Well, that one didn't make the list. We didn't get that from your,
Derek
from your
agent. Derek got excited when he heard
that.
Yeah,
man, I was like, whoa, okay, here we go. So if we start talking and we kind of just go blank and you don't hear anything, we're watching college football here on the TV. So all three of us now have our eyes up and kind of watching. But
who are you pulling for, Texas or OU?
Man, I mean, my brother-in-law is a huge OU fan. Uh-huh. But I mean Texas, I guess. Okay. I mean, neither one. I don't care about either one of these.
What about
teams.
You, Andy? Sandy. Andy, sorry.
Sandy. Andy, Sandy, yeah. Whoever you are.
Oh, I'm a Longhorn fan all the way.
Okay. All right.
Well, there you go. So we're all pulling for Texas. Brandon?
I'm not. I'm an Aggie fan, so
there you
in
go.
Arkansas. Uh-huh. So
okay. Well, whatever. Sandy, again, man, thank you for driving up and talking to us.
My pleasure. So glad to be here.
So for the guys that don't know your legendary status, how did you become a legend?
Most of it was myth and innuendos.
Bullshit.
And,
a bunch of bullshit.
A bunch of bullshit.
And alcohol.
A lot of alcohol. I was a tactical bullshitter from years back and basically just put a bunch of stuff out there that no one could dispute because they didn't have evidence to the otherwise. So people believed it.
I mean, here's the deal. If you've been a part of TTPOA for... I mean, how long have you been a part of it?
Started in 1995.
So, God, I can't even do the math on that. That's carry the three, the four.
That's
a long time.
I just said the year because right? I can't do the math.
Yeah, so if you've been a part of TTPO at all, you know who Sandy is. You're at the conference every year.
Yeah.
You do some speaking at the conference. You also teach for Safariland. So if you've ever been through a Safariland instructor school, less than lethal school, gas school, whatever it is, Sandy's probably there.
Have you missed a conference?
I don't believe so. I don't think I've ever missed a conference.
Everyone I've ever been to, you've been there in some capacity.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I've missed one.
The inventor of the wall banger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that something that we can talk about?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it's a tool for SWAT.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, sorry.
something else.
I was going for something.
We're running a special right now, as a matter of fact.
And also, we'll get to this later. Now, you've written a book.
He's an author.
Yeah.
Is there anything? Did you write this yourself?
Well, believe it or not, I did. Now, my wife had a big part in the making it grammatically correct so that a publisher would even look at it because I have a real big problem with spelling and all that. But she was a 23-year high school teacher, and so she would mark it up with red ink and hand it back to me and say, this is trash, this is junk, I'm not even going to finish this. And so I'd sulk for a while and go back into my office and I'd write it all over again, and then I'd hand it to her and she'd still write it up, but she'd, well, that's a little better, but it's still junk. And then usually about the third or fourth time she'd go, you know, that's pretty good. And so then I'd take it and put it in a little file, and then I'd start on another story.
So here's the book. It's called The Long Road Home. Now, what's your target audience here?
Well, it's obviously law enforcement.
Okay, so that's what I was thinking. And I'm flipping through it, and you were kind enough to bring us two copies. Sad thing is, there's no pictures in this book, okay? So I don't know if your SWAT cops, especially Brandon here, are going to be able to read this without any pictures.
I actually offered pictures up, and the publisher said, no, this is not that kind of book. We don't want pictures in there. So I had to, trust her judgment on that.
Yeah.
Didn't put any.
Well, hey, we'll get to the book here in a little bit, right? Yeah. So tell us, how long were you HPD?
28 years.
Okay. And how long were you on SWAT?
22.
So when did you start?
Oh my gosh. 1976 was when I entered the academy, and then I graduated, and then I retired in 2004.
Okay. So. Derek was not even born in 76 yet.
I was not. I was not. I was born in 79.
I was, yeah. I was one.
Yeah. That is crazy.
You know, we kind of look alike. No, never mind.
Well, no, our last guest was my son, so we kidding about him. So, so started that. What, how'd your career start?
You know, just a small kid in a little bitty town and, wanted to be a game warden, believe it or not. Okay. And then I looked at how much they made, which wasn't much at the time. I think they're doing a lot better with the TV show, but, then I, went to college for a couple of years and just, it wasn't my thing. And, got a job as a night security guard and, patrolling around little town of Victoria, and occasionally I'd find an open door. Never found any forced entry or anything, but our protocol was call the police. So they'd come out, and every once in a while they'd say, "You got a gun?" I said, "Well, I got a shotgun in the truck. Get it." And man, I'd get it, and then I'd be all scared, and I'd follow this officer as we searched the building.
Holy shit, can you imagine that?
Yeah.
God, and, the 70s sounds so fun.
Exactly. And luckily, never found anything, but it just, man, I was thrilled, and I said, this is the life for me.
Yeah.
So then I thought, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to go to a big city, you know. Yeah. And nothing wrong with small-time cops, because they see a lot of the same things we do see. It's just a lot more of it in the big city.
Right.
And so I thought, and they paid a lot, and I looked around and I considered San Antonio, Austin, and Houston, which were the ones closest to me, and Houston was paying the most of the time, and they were recruiting, so I gave them a call, and the rest is history.
Awesome. Isn't it weird how you ask guys, like, hey, why did you choose so-and-so? You're like, oh, man, it's this and that, but, man, they were paying the most of the time.
Yeah.
Everybody's following the money.
Yeah. Do you remember what that was back then?
Oh, God, I have no idea. Yeah. I want to say, you making about 19,000, you know, as a patrol officer, not in the academy or anything, but something like that.
I'm rich.
Yeah.
Golly, man.
I remember extra jobs at the time was $5.75 an hour. And I just thought that, God, I'm so big time now.
An extra job paid $5 and something an hour?
Yeah, $5.75 an hour.
You won't even. And I'm sure this is across the state, across the country. Right now, where I'm at, they're paying us $60 an hour.
Oh,
we won't do it for anything less than $60 an hour.
I can't imagine that.
Yeah. $5 an hour.
$5.75.
And that's at a nightclub where you were beating heads and getting your head beat.
Oh, my gosh.
And, oh, yeah, it was bad. I worked a biker joint for several years, and, it was a fight every night, and we were getting paid $5.75 an hour.
Was it worth it?
Yeah. Oh, hell no. But I was young and crazy and stupid, I'm still stupid, but, it was a lot of fun. Actually.
That's awesome.
We had a lot of fun.
So your career starts out. How does that go into patrol? And then, then what?
Yeah, I did the patrol thing and then obviously went to patrol. And I was hoping to go to a really, slum area of Houston to get a lot of action. And they put me out in Northwest, which is what we called the Ponderosa at the time, because it was a newer part of Houston, less populated, upper income people. So the crime wasn't as bad. They had their murder here and there and robberies here and there, but nothing like you would have in one of the ward areas is what we call it in Houston.
So we're talking 76, 77, 78.
Yeah.
So what, for these younger audience, what is a squad car back then? What was that like? I mean, like,
it was a Plymouth Fury, and they had those big V8 engines and 4-barrel carburetors, and those things would scream. And oh my God, it was fun. We had a blast. And luckily, I'd never wrecked one. I was in some wrecks when some other people were driving, and we had a lot of other guys getting bad wrecks just going way too fast because those things, they would scream.
Probably handle like a boat and
we had one car, a key to the car, and no radios, no handheld radios, so when the protocol was, when you got into an apartment complex or whatever, you take the key out of the car and drop it in the floorboard, leave the car doors open, and if we needed help, you either had to get to a phone somewhere in an apartment or make your way back to the car, get the key out of, find it in the floorboard, get it in the ignition, turn it on, and then get on the radio and call for help. And I had to do that more than once.
That's insane.
How does someone not steal your car?
I don't know. We're just lucky. But and then we got two keys, and we thought, oh my God, we don't have to leave a key in the car anymore. Now we're really high speed.
Oh my God!
And my last year in patrol, they finally gave us walkie talkies, and then we thought, oh yeah, this is it. This is Star Trek stuff. This is amazing.
That just changes the use of force. I mean, that just changes because that changes the totality of stuff. Yeah. Hey, it's just me. I can't ask for help. So that's such.
Wait, did you guys have use of force in the 70s?
No, it was a nightstick right between the running lights.
Yeah. I mean, it's just totally different. I mean, how you have to handle business and stuff. Is
absolutely.
Totally different.
I can remember one situation, me and my partner, we always rode two man. I mean, they would have a one man unit out there and there were female officers occasionally, but we just called them one man. Even the female officers would get on the radio, and we call it SO, which is sign on for your tour. And you'd have a female voice say, you know, sign on one man. Uh-huh. It was just the terminology we used. Nobody thought anything about it. And but I can remember me and my partner getting a fight with, let me just say we were in a fight and we were outnumbered, and I got to the car and got the key in, and this guy's trying to drag me out of the car, and I'm kicking him with my legs. And in my back window, I can see my partner fighting off two guys. And I pulled my pistol and I said, "This is it." And I was just going to squeeze the shot. And this big forearm, is about as big as Derek's, comes around the guy's neck and yanks him backwards. And it was some two big redneck looking dudes. And they brought their cowboy boots for a reason. they stomped a mud hole in those guys' face.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was so glad to see him because I was fixing to to light this guy up.
So, the 70s were great.
So how long did you spend in patrol?
3 years, just a little over 3 years.
So 3 years. So what drew you, why did you want to go to SWAT? Or did you always, SWAT was kind of new,
right? How do you know you went to SWAT after 3 years?
Yeah. I had to pull a stint.
That's a good point.
Say, I'm small.
Yeah, you are smart. You should read more.
I had to pull a stint in the jail, and it was kind of like getting drafted. If your number came up randomly, and if it came up, you either went to dispatch or you went to jail, and you spent 6 months. But the only good thing is after your 6 months, you had the option to leave, and you could automatically go back to where you came from, or you could go to some other part of the city. So I did my 6 months in the jail, and I hated it, but I learned so much. It was a lot of fun, and a lot of the stories in that book are from what happens in the jail.
Really?
And it's some things that, in fact, my daughter now is a prosecutor for Fort Bend County, and she read the book, and she said, "Dad, are you sure you want to publish this? Because things that you write about here that and I said, "Darling, the statute of limitations is up. Besides, I've changed all the names, and there's a disclaimer in the back of the book that it's fiction." And and she said, "Okay." But anyway, my first about that time there was this TV show called Miami Vice.
Heck yeah.
And Don Johnson. I thought that was a cool dude, man. And I wanted to have a sailboat have an alligator and live on the boat and all the things he did. So I applied to go to narcotics.
Oh yeah,
and that's where I went first. And I really love narcotics, and that was a lot of fun. But
who doesn't love narcotics? Right?
real reason I wanted to go to narcotics because they had this new thing called the raid team. Narcotics had been involved in a really controversial shooting. It was like about six narcotics officers all shot by like a 68-year-old man, almost as old as me.
Oh, dang.
And anyway, it was one of those just tragic deals. And you had guys that were kicking doors, and they were long haired and beards. And of course the allegation was, man, I didn't know who these guys were. Mm-hmm. Well, we said we were police. Well, so the new idea was we're going to put together a small team, and they're going to train firearms. They're going to train in entry tactics. They're going to be clean shaven. They're going to be short haired. They're going to look like cops.
Yeah.
And this is all they're going to do. So the idea was, if that's all they do, then obviously they're going to be better at it rather than going and buying dope. And so like a SWAT concept, but strictly related to narcotics entries. And so I was lucky enough to get on that. And that's all we did. You know, we were 3, 4, 5, 6 warrants a day all over the city. Don't get me wrong. I look back on it now, and we were doing some stupid, stupid things.
Yeah.
But it was really high speed for the time.
Oh, I bet.
And later on, even when I got into SWAT, I was thinking we were high speed. This is tier one stuff.
Yeah.
And I look back on it now thinking, that was stupid.
Why are we doing this stupid shit? Right. Isn't it funny how we learn as we get older?
Yeah.
So how long did you do that?
I did narcotics. I was in narcotics for 3 years. And I ended up meeting my wife, and we got married. And I realized that no one in narcotics was staying married. They either had just gotten married or just gotten divorced or were somewhere in the transitional process.
But dudes in SWAT were? Like, what the hell, Sandy?
They just stayed longer than 2 years. It was like a 4-year marriage. Yeah.
Well, I thought I had a better shot at it anyway. So I knew I was going to either stay in narcotics or stay married, but the two were not compatible. So there was this opening on the SWAT team. And I thought, you know, maybe that's a more stable job. And I've got a shot of staying married. So I tried out for that.
Year is that?
That's, I kind of jumped ahead. I actually went to SWAT first. Uh-huh. And that was in 79, and I stayed for 3 years. Then I went to narcotics.
Okay.
For 3 years. And then that's when I got married, and I said, well, I'm going to go back to SWAT. Okay. And so
my original question was right.
Yeah.
So I'm not stupid.
Yeah.
So what drew you to SWAT?
Okay. Just the excitement. I thought, you know, that we were going to be doing hostage rescues all the time and just, you know, kicking doors and taking names. And the way Houston operated in 79 was nothing like that. We had a little bit of hostage rescue capabilities, but to be totally honest, we were very lacking in that matter. We were basically
flying by the seat of your pants,
a surround. And gassed the crap out of them, you know. And there was a few hostage situations that I don't know. We performed poorly, but we didn't really lose any hostages. I think we got luckier than anything else. But we handled barricades very, very well. We did a lot of searching of buildings and finding crooks hiding and that kind of thing. We didn't run any narcotic search warrants. Narcotics ran all of theirs. Mm-hmm. Now, the second time we come back around, we had started training with the Army special op guys. They call the D-Boys. I don't think I'm supposed to say their name. But anyway.
Yeah. Those guys that don't exist.
Yeah, that don't exist. And everybody knows who they are. But those guys were really high speed, and they started teaching us about dynamic entry the right way, or at least a much better way. Yeah. And then we started getting into narcotics entries, and we started running almost all theirs. Narcotics ran most of theirs, but all of their ones that were either suspects were heavily armed, heavily fortified, or propensity to commit violence. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a little criteria there. And then they would hand it off to us, and we would run it.
Do all that.
And so they kept us pretty busy then. And then for some reason, the hostage situation started coming along, and we had some pretty prolific ones, some that went very well and some went tragically wrong.
So this time frame of your career, having bring in other guys that are showing you different ways and stuff, was that something that was hard for some of the guys on the team to accept, like, hey, man, this is our tactic, this is what we do? And then other guys are like, well, let's be open-minded. Was there some friction back then?
Absolutely. Yeah. Nobody likes change, you know, especially if you've been doing something a certain way, and now somebody wants to come in, especially a newer guy.
Yeah.
And there was always that. Yeah. And there probably have been that since the dawn of time, and we'll continue to do that. But yeah, absolutely.
Were you one of the newer guys that had some vision, had some like, hey, I want to look at different things? And were you one of those kind of guys that kind of,
yeah, absolutely.
Brought in, because I would imagine so, if you've been beginning with TTPOA and just knowing your career and stuff like that, you have to be a forward thinking, going, hey, I'm willing to look at other things and stuff like that.
All right. Yeah. You know, I'll be honest with you. When I first heard about these guys from Fort Bragg, I thought, yeah, really, what can they teach us? I mean, they're fighting armies and artillery and all that kind of stuff. And then the first time I went out and trained with them, I went, holy shit.
It's a different level.
Yeah, these guys are good.
Yeah.
And so they opened my mind to a whole nother way of thinking. And you know what? To the credit of the older guys, once we had to bring them out and actually let them see it, they didn't take long for them to become convinced. Yeah, I see what you're saying now. Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. I remember you spoke at one of the conferences 1 year, or you were doing something, and you were talking about a training that y'all were at with them, and something crashed, and I was like, damn, that's insane. That's the way they train.
Yeah.
Like, that was just.
Yeah. Yeah. That's I wanted to put that story in the book, but it'll be in the sequel, assuming I buy one. But they were doing night entries on a structure that we had out in the middle of the county. And they were coming in, you know, with lights out, two operators on either side on the skids, and a helicopter, a pilot and a co-pilot. Mm-hmm. And they were on little birds. And you couldn't even see them. You just hear them. You hear them coming. And so we're standing out there watching. And all of a sudden, there was this crash and sparks and things flying. And we heard things whizzing overhead. And we all hit the ground like, what the hell? And then we jump up and start turning on our flashlights. And this little bird's sideways. And you can see the pilot and the co-pilot are sitting in there. And I see two guys run past me from the helicopter running off toward the target. And I'm like, I guess they're hurt or something. They're getting away from the crash. We go running over there, and the pilots are screaming. There's two guys underneath us. The two guys that were on one side when the helicopter flipped over pinned them underneath it. So we're over there heaving on this helicopter, trying to get them up, and more guys start showing up. And we finally get enough people, and we get it up enough, and we pull these two guys out. One of them's hurt pretty bad. They ended up life flighting him. And then in all this chaos, I realize now there was shooting going on in the background. But I just focused on what I was doing, I didn't really pay attention to it. And then just about the time we get the guys out and things are coming calming down, these two guys come walking back, and I realize they're the two operators on the other side that ran from the helicopter and hit the target. And I looked at them like, where the hell you guys been? They said, well, we hit the target. I said, my God, it was a crash. Your guys were underneath. He says, well, that's what we'd have done in a real deal. And I looked at them like, you know, they're right.
Yeah.
But that's the way they train. I don't care if it's training or whatever. We're going to do it like we would do it in a real deal.
That's a commitment right there.
You're that's it.
Hey, buddy, come on, help me.
That's insane. I'm crushed.
Sorry, man. I got to hit the target.
That's a level of commitment that a lot of people don't have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Holy shit.
Yeah, and that's I remember that story. I'm like, wow, man, that stuck in my mind all these years.
And there's another one in there that I did put in the book, and it's the same deal. It has to do with the pilots, this guy is just taking a chance with this bird that this is going to work, and we're all in it. And I asked him the next day, I said, well, what would have happened? We were drinking beer, and he tipped my beer, and he said, well, we wouldn't be here right now, would we? And he just smiled like he couldn't give a shit either way. And I'm looking at him like, this guy's crazy.
Yeah. Well, one of our first podcasts, we had Gravy, Coker.
Greg Coker, yeah.
And, man, the stories he had, I want to do another podcast with him because he was so fascinating. I ended up listening to his book on audio.
Because Brandon can't read.
Well, no, I was exercising and, you know.
No, you weren't.
Okay, but it was amazing just the stories that guy had and just the, once again, the commitment level and just the professionalism of how to fly that plane.
How
the helicopter.
Yeah,
just amazing. Amazing stuff. Okay, so starting out changing kind of SWAT, y'all's mission set and things like that. So that's where we left off, right?
Yep. Yeah. So, okay. So let's see. We're talking earlier, and you talked about some of the mistakes that were made on the history of the TTPOA podcast.
Mm, yeah.
So,
what mistakes is just they left things out
because they're old and
inaccuracies,
old and forgetful, right?
Absolutely. That's why I made notes.
So what is your story on how all of this got started? And when you started that thing years ago, can you imagine?
Oh.
So it's 95 is our, because I think there was a debate on what year it started, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I looked it up.
Okay.
So I've got my notes here. It actually all started in 1983, and it was up in the Dallas area. The agencies that I was able to research was DFW, Bedford, Dallas, and then they invited Houston to come up. And it wasn't even called TTPOA. It was called the Alliance. Huh. And they started this organization, and I can remember I had just made – back on the SWAT team, and our lieutenant asked if anybody wanted to be part of this. These guys from Dallas were going to start an organization, and I'm learning how to be a SWAT officer. I ain't got time for this. But to his credit, a guy named Paul Day said, hey, I'll go. And so the lieutenant gave him a trip car and enough money for a hotel, and he went up to Dallas and stayed for 2 days and came back, and he said, yeah, we started this alliance thing, and it's going to be pretty cool. And it kind of floundered, and not much happened. And then in 1990, a guy named Manny Vasquez from Dallas PD got it going again, and they decided to call it the TTPOA. Hmm. And Manny was the first president.
Okay.
And he was president for 2 years, and then he had aspirations, and I think he became a captain or maybe even an assistant chief within Dallas PD. Mm-hmm. So a guy named Tom Shelton stepped up. And that was in 92.
I've heard that name.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was everything that we kind of talked about on that podcast.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
he became the second president of TTPOA. Yeah. And he ran it for a little while, and it kind of just floundered. It never really got going. About the only thing they had going for them was a few schools here and there, mainly in the Dallas area. Uh-huh. And then they did a little conference. So they usually had about 70, 80 people at it.
Wow.
And it was no practical training. They just got together in a hotel room or a hotel ballroom area and told stories and had a few debriefs and had and a guest drink. Speaker and a lot of drinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was basically their conference. And so it's funny that we should be doing this podcast at the competition, because that's where it all started for me with TTPOA. It was 1995. We had come back from competing at the Florida SWAT Roundup.
Okay.
And the next year we said, we're going to go compete at TTPOA for our first time. And Dallas was going to be there, and they were kind of the big kids on the block. And we were thinking, yeah, man, that'll be, and then Austin was going to be there. Mm-hmm. I don't think San Antonio was, but some other, and then a lot of smaller agencies, and you know, they were all a lot of good competition. Yeah. And it was down in Harlingen, Texas. Mm-hmm. And after the competition, a guy named Paul Ford came up to me, mm-hmm. and he said, hey man, this TTPOA thing, it's kind of floundering. And I went to the conference, and it's, they really need leadership. And he said, they also have a Command magazine that they tried to get going. He says, I have some experience in editing. I would be willing to take over that Command magazine, but yeah. I need somebody to run the organization, to be president. And I was wondering if you'd do it. And I looked at him like, man, I don't
why'd know you pick me?
Yeah. And I'm like, I don't have any, I'm Sandy, I'm telling you, you got the gift for gab.
Yeah.
I think you can convince people. You could go do this. And so after several more beers or a lot of Jack Daniels, he convinced me.
So are you saying without Sandy Wall, there is no TTPOA?
No. I'm not saying that.
That's what I'm hearing.
No. He, without Paul Ford.
Yeah.
Because Paul Ford convinced me. And if it wouldn't have been me, he'd have convinced somebody else.
Now, did y'all know each other pretty well or not?
No. That first time I met him down there at the competition.
Wow.
Man. And so anyway, so he said, come to the conference. We're going to have it in Austin. And this was in January of 96. Okay. And I come there, and I was pretty impressed. It was about 75, 80 people there and from around the state. And once again, there was no practical training offsite. It was just, we're all there in this big ballroom area, and we're sharing stories and vendors. And vendors, it was like maybe 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. And so they said, we need a new president, and Paul's letting me to get up and talk. So I get up and said, okay, guys, hey, you know what? I'll throw my name in a hat. I'll run, and here's what I think I can do. And I sat back down, and nobody else got up and talked. So then Paul just steps up and says,
elected.
Okay,
good
yeah.
job.
Everybody show your hands and votes for Sandy. And everybody raised their hand. And so I'm like, okay, I guess I'm president. So after this meeting, we go off in this little room, and they hand me the shoebox. And they said, okay, here is the records from the TTPOA.
A shoebox.
And I open it up, and there's a copy of the bylaws and then some receipts and stuff. And they said, oh, by the way, we don't know how we're going to pay the hotel bill because we're in debt. But we'll figure it out. We're gonna go out and pass a hat. So I think they did. They went out and passed the hat. Came up with enough money to pay the hotel bill. And then the next day, Paul Ford was going to be running a explosive breaching class out at their range with Alan Brosnan. He was bringing him down. Mm-hmm. So we were going to make some money from that. So we were going to be solvent again by maybe a couple of $100, right? So I go back to Houston the next day, and I'm thinking, what have I gotten myself into? And I got a guy named Ronnie Parker, who's legendary. He's Captain Dynamite in the book. And I talked him into being my treasurer. And we get the bylaws out, and I read the bylaws, and I realize I wasn't even elected per the bylaws. The rules were all thrown out the window. But it looked like nobody had been following the rules for a while. And nothing against Tommy Shelton, because he was trying to hold this ship together.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't happening. So I found a lady by the name of Jan Rich. She was an attorney for the police department. And she had a lot of experience with 501c3s. Okay. And she gets to checking us. She said, Sandy, you've lost your incorporation. What? Yeah, your incorporation with the state of Texas. And I said, well, what's the big deal about that? And she said, that's your protection liability-wise. And I said, what are you saying? She said, well, if y'all have a training accident, they can come after all of the board members individually, after you personally, because the corporation is your protection. And I look and I said, we just did an explosive breaching school. And she's like, oh, my God. "You're kidding me." And I said, I called Paul. I said, "Did anybody get hurt?" He said, "No, we're good. We're good.
Shut
it
down.
We're good.
Shut it down."
So I said, "What does it take?" And so, you know, to her credit, she filed all the paperwork. We got incorporated again. And then she says, "Why are you guys not a 501c3?" And I said, "I don't know. What does it take?" And she said, "I'll make you a 501c3.
Oh my gosh.
So she gets all that paperwork together and she says, "Here's what I need you to do. I need you to get together a scholarship, because we need to be philanthropic. That's part of it." Uh-huh. And so we had recently had a Pasadena SWAT officer killed there in the Houston area by the name of Les Early.
Okay.
So I called them up and I said, "Look, I'm going to start a scholarship for the association, and I'd like to name it after him." And they were all for it. You know, they said, "Sure, absolutely." So that's how the Les Early scholarship got started. And so we didn't have a website or anything. So I got a guy named John Murphy who was on my team, and he knew a little bit about that kind of stuff. I said, "John, would you make us a website?" And he did. And we started doing that. And then it was just one thing after another. And we started rebuilding this organization. And then Paul, bless his heart, he did wonders with that magazine. Mm-hmm, I mean, every time a magazine came out, we had to go do another school or two to pay for the printing. But we got it done. We were literally, I mean, on a shoestring. I mean, literally, I was having to hold bills because we had no money.
Oh, and the next, gosh.
And give them excuse. And then a school would come in, we'd get a little bit of money, and I'd pay that bill.
Well, I'm glad they bamboozled you into doing this.
Oh, my God.
I brought a lot of stuff up.
My wife was looking at me like, "What have you gotten into?"
Yeah, that's a full-time job that you just took
over.
Oh, it was.
And thank goodness I had a lieutenant at the time that was very supportive, and he just gave me full rein. He said that whatever you need to do.
Just take care of it.
He said, "Just take care of it." He said, "I want you at training, and I want you at call-ups, but if there's any free time, I don't care if it's on duty, off duty, whatever. I think this is a worthwhile effort." So
when did you see all that effort? Like, when were you like, "Holy shit, this is going to be a thing"?
Yeah. We have money.
Well, we ran the first competition. I'm back up a minute. That first competition in 95 was actually through the Police Athletic Federation. Mm-hmm. TTPOA didn't run it. We had nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I said, TTPOA needs to be running this. This should not be a Police Athletic Federation deal. So the next year, we took it from them, and it was a little bit, they were like, "Well, that's our event." I said, "No, well, you can have your event, but we're going to have ours."
Yeah.
And they said, "Well, we don't want to compete against you." And I said, "Right, y'all come on out, help us. We'll let you have a booth, but this is going to be our event."
Yeah.
And they agreed finally, and we took it over. And the first one was in Houston, and man, we had probably 20 teams we thought were huge.
Yeah.
You know, it's nothing what you guys do now, but San Antonio came out for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And of course, you know, that was a mistake because now they kicked our ass ever since then. But
I think Garland won the first one.
Probably did.
We were looking at that deal.
I believe so.
I think Garland was the first.
It wasn't.
Yeah. I think he just made that shit.
No, I have pictures somewhere from last year.
Yeah, Garland had a hell of a team. I remember those guys.
Because our guys, our original SWAT, when we formed, we came to Houston to mm-hmm. get trained by y'all. I don't know if you're part of that or not, but
probably.
But I remember that's when we started a team. They sent guys down there to get trained up and stuff.
So I'm looking at these regions that are drawn up, and they used highways to draw the regions. Well, there were highways that went between counties. You know, like there was, you know, Gonzales County. There's on the north side of I-10 and the south side. I-10. That didn't make sense. So I changed it all and said we're going to make them counties, and that's when we started separating them then. And there were regions that nobody was even a representative of.
Yeah.
So I had, luckily, because we did schools, and I had friends all over the state, so I called guys out of El Paso that I knew, and I said, "Hey, need somebody for this region. Somebody down in Brownsville, need somebody
so
for
you
this
created region." The regions then?
Well, yeah, we just drew them up.
Cool.
And so started filling those spots. And so we got a representative for every region. And so anyway,
what year is this?
This is still 96.
Still
putting it all together.
Okay.
And so at the time in 96, we ran a conference and a competition at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And the idea was
together. Okay.
Yeah. So the first 2 days,
same event.
First 2 days was a conference. And then the second 2 days was the competition. It was a 4-day event. And the idea was that police, chiefs and sheriffs would send their guys if they were going to a conference, but they probably wouldn't send their guys just to go compete because they considered a big testosterone thing. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were coming for the conference and they stay over 2 more days and compete. Okay.
Right.
And it seemed to work out. And so we reached out to, and we changed the format at the time. Like, NTOA and a lot of the other conferences, they did all tracks. So you had a commander's track, you had a team leader's track, you had an operator track, you had a sniper track. And we changed that. We said, no, we're just going to have schools and our classes. And there'll be operator level, instructor level, or just a conference level that you just, you know, you lecture. And so we changed that. And that seemed to be pretty popular. And then every year the conference was growing. And then pretty soon NTOA was coming to our conference going, what are you guys doing differently? And then we said, well, we're not doing those track things, you know, because people didn't want to sign up. And then you tell them what they're taking just because they're a sniper. Right. They wanted individually picked. And so they may still do some tracks, but they changed a lot of theirs. So we were up and coming. That was around 96, 97. And then this conference thing got to be a testosterone thing in and of itself because what we did in Houston, Abilene, Shannon Couch, bless his heart, he said, I'm going to beat that number. And because we had like about 150.
And Shannon is still doing this today. He's downstairs running around, you know.
Yeah, we had like about 150 in Houston. And so now he said, I'm going to go do 200. We're all looking at him like, he's crazy. Damn it if he didn't do 200. So the next year it's in Austin, and Paul Ford said, I'm gonna beat 200. And we said, there's no way you're going to beat 200. He did 500.
Damn.
And we like, holy crap. So now it's back in Houston. So we did 550 in Houston. So then when it went to Dallas, God, it blew up. I mean, I can't remember that year. I think they did something like 700 in Dallas. We were just – and so
– That's awesome.
That's – all the time frame when things were just being built just upon themselves. And once we got the right foundation, it's like building a house. Yeah. It just needed the right foundation and then it would grow. And then it's just a matter of getting the right people in that really want to be here for the right reasons, not just because they want to go to the hospitality suite and they want an expensive car. It's I'm here to produce and produce for this association.
So do you remember who the first Region 7 director was?
No, we just had five regions back then.
Okay.
That all developed later on. And so when I passed the torch and went on, I went to Safariland and started working there. I would just come to the conferences, and every year I was amazed how much more you guys were doing. And then this time I walked to this competition. I haven't made a competition in probably 4 or 5 years, and I was just blown away.
Yeah.
Well, you should have been here yesterday. We had the vendor show set up downstairs where we walked you through. Oh, my God. There was people, vendors, everything in there.
That's amazing. I should have been here yesterday. That was great.
Now we have a podcast and apps on your phone. And
I'm trying to see if I missed anything. I think I got most of it. But, that's pretty much it. That's how it all got going. And then, I wanted where we brought in Mike Finley. So when we're in Abilene, we're looking at nobody on the board is from Dallas. We need to get, that's a huge city. We need to get somebody from that Dallas area. And I knew Steve Claggett. So I hit up Steve, and Steve says, no, man, I'm not the guy. And I'm like, come on, Steve. And he said, I tell you, the guy is Mike Finley. And I didn't really know Mike Finley. I heard the name. And we said, is he here? And he said, yeah, he's here. So we brought him in. And of course, we fed him a lot of Jack Daniels. And the next thing you know, he said yes.
Yeah.
And so that was then kind of the fearsome foursome that we got going. You got your Shannon Couch. You got your Paul Ford and Mike Finley and myself. And then it just started building. And then the thing was, once again, it's kind of like SWAT guys. It's competition.
Yeah.
I wanted to outdo him, and he wanted to outdo him, and he wanted to outdo him. But it was who was benefiting? It was the association.
Yep. Yeah. You kind of see that now.
Yeah.
You see guys trying to outdo each other on certain things or whatever it is. But
And we had a lot of philanthropic people in the Houston area, and I was always going around with a SWAT coffee cup and a SWAT hat and a SWAT T-shirt. And, hey, your kid, does he want to shoot a machine gun?
Yeah.
And then I'd take him out, let him shoot a machine gun. Next thing you know, they write me a $5,000 check to the association. Yeah. It was great.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
It is amazing what you can do when you truly want to partner with someone and you're not wanting, just give me, give me, give me. And you're like, hey, there's something in it for you that I want you to see. And then I want you to experience this. And I found some of the best people that I meet are when we come to these conferences or competitions, whether they're SWAT guys or some of these vendors. I mean, some of these vendors are the nicest people. Because they're just good folks that care about us, and they're doing all kinds of stuff for us. I'm like, they're giving what away in this and that? I'm this is crazy.
I'm just blown away. We didn't have near that back then, and nothing against them. They wanted to help us, and if not for their money, we couldn't have done half of what we did. Yeah. But the kind of things that they give away now, I'm blown away.
That 1 year, and consistently, you know, we're giving away 13, 14, 15 guns at the conference, you know, from the raffle. And
never won one, never had, can't win one. So I'm like, golly.
You get plenty of red t-shirts and Ranger panties.
I know,
Ranger panties. You're good.
Ranger
panties. You're good.
Today.
You're good. You don't need anything
all
else.
I have is red t-shirts with TTPOA on them.
Let's talk about the book a little bit. Why did you want to write a book? Like,
well,
everything you've done, man, like you just.
Yeah. You know, it's just like you guys. Every cop has a whole bunch of stories, right? And I would go to, you know, say a party with my wife and all of her teacher friends, and yeah. Hey, tell a story. Hey, tell that story you told me the other time. And so I get to telling stories, yeah. And the comment was always, "You ought to write a book, man." And I'm like, "I can't write a book." And then Tom Majors, bless his heart, you guys all
yeah.
know Tom.
Yeah.
He hit me up about 15 years ago, I guess, maybe 12 years ago, to write a book with him, and we called it Training the SWAT Trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more of a textbook kind of thing. And he did all the heavy lifting, but I wrote my part of it. And then I thought, you know, maybe I could write a book
for that.
And and then it came time to retire, literally retire, not just from HPD, but also from Safari Land. And I'm thinking, you know, I've got to stay real busy or I'm going to become an alcoholic. And so, because all my buddies that weren't busy, you know, they just decided to sit on their porch and watch the world go by. Next thing you know, they're fixing a drink. And next thing you know, they can't stop drinking. And so I said, I got to stay busy. And so I said, you know what? I'm going to sit down and I'm just going to start writing stories. And I'm just going to put them in a folder. And so I decided I was going to write all the stories that I can remember about the academy. And I was going to write all the stories I can remember about patrol and about jail and about narcotics and then eventually about SWAT. And so I started out with the academy writing stories and go through that little editing process with my wife.
Yeah.
And once I lived through that, and I'd stick it in that little folder. And I had about 8 or 10 stories about the academy, and then I had a lot more than that about patrol, and then just as many about the jail, and then eventually narcotics. And when I wrote them all, then that took me about 3 years because I just,
wow.
Well, and I just work on an hour, 2 hours in the morning because I'm an early bird. I get up usually around 3-4 o'clock in the morning, and my wife doesn't get up till 5 or 6. So for a couple hours, I just sit in there and write. And that kept me busy. And so about 3 years of doing that, I finally got all these stories. So then I said, okay, now I got to connect them somehow. So that's where I came up with this fictional character named Andy Wallace.
See, that's why I called him Andy earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
See?
And
Andy Wallace.
Uh-huh.
Sandy Wall.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh,
I actually knew a guy named one of the guys at HPD. His name was Andy Wallace. He's not in the book, but he's a good guy. Anyway, so I started trying to. This is where I guess if there is any credit to really writing, not just telling a story, is coming up with this fictitional storyline that connects all of these stories. And that took me another year. And then I got them all written, and then I thought, okay, what do you think? And my wife says, you know, I think this is pretty good. And she reads a lot.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, I got this buddy named Johnny Bonds. He was a famous homicide detective and had written a book called The Cop Who Wouldn't Quit. And it was about a whodunit that he saw.
Oh, okay.
And so he was retired now. So I called him up and I told him about it. He said, send it to me. I'll read it. And I said, really? He said, yeah, and I'll tell you what I think. And I knew Johnny. He's straight shooter.
He wouldn't bullshit with you.
He wouldn't bullshit with me. And it took about 2 weeks, and he called me back, and he said, oh, my God, this is good, Sandy. And I said, what? He said, I'm telling you, I get people send me stuff all the time. And he said, I have yet to see anything worth even passing on to a publisher. But he said, I will send this to a publisher that I know.
For oh, wow.
You. And I said, do it. And next thing you know, the publisher's calling me, said, I want to publish this.
That's awesome. And I don't know how you remember all that. I just – people ask me, hey, tell me a story of this. I'm like, I just can't remember stuff. Yeah. Now, if all three of us did something and you start talking, I was there, then I remember it, but I can't come up with them on my own. Yeah. But I love, there's guys that I know in my department that are great storytellers. I'm like, I can just sit and listen to, and I was there. I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. And
yeah.
It sounds much better now that you're telling it and stuff. So,
well, I mean, I can tell stories, but not a fucking book worth of stories.
Well, you're just lying. I mean,
yeah, I bet you guys are being modest. Everybody, every cop's got, most of them are funny. Yeah. There's some of them are tragic.
What's your favorite story from the book?
Oh man, that's a tough one. But I would have to say there was a guy in narcotics. I'm gonna not say his real name, but in the book his name I think is Jimmy Duncan or something like that. And he was an old crotchety old guy that everybody liked, right? And he had paid his dues, been in narcotics for years, and the captain liked him. And so when we developed a SWAT team, he said, "Put Duncan on the raid team." And we're like, "This guy doesn't even carry a gun." He didn't. He had carried a briefcase with him, and he put his gun in the briefcase. And that's it. That's
what.
And he would shoot one time a year when the agency made him, and then he wouldn't even clean it. He'd pay a guy $25 to clean his gun for him. I mean, he was just the most non-tech.
Oh my gosh!
But he was a great guy and a chain smoker. Oh my God! He lit one with the end of the other, and all of his stories were back in the day. And he called me Sprout, you know, like a little bitty weed Sprout. And he go, "I was doing this shit when you were shitting yellow.
You're shitting yellow.
Yeah, exactly. So he was that kind of guy, right? And he's always smoking a cigarette. And so we're going to run this heroin warrant on the east side of town, really bad part of town, a lot of heroin dealers over there. And at the time, we were really short-staffed. It was a Friday afternoon. Everybody had taken off early. So we had like six guys to enter this house. And so the sergeant who was running the team said, "Hey, no problem. I'll get a couple patrol officers to help us and cover the back and the front." And so Duggar, he usually just drove the van. He never even got out of the van. He just drove the van. That was his job. And that we were fine with that because we were a little scared when he pulled us. If he ever pulled it out, he was a little scared about it.
Yeah.
So he tells, there's a one-man unit shows up. That's all we got. And so the sergeant didn't want to send this guy to the back of the house by himself. So he looks at Duggar and says, "Hey, Duggar, you go cover the back with this patrol officer.
Get your briefcase."
Well, he gets a little nervous, like, "What? You actually want to get out of the van?" He said, "Yeah, I need you to get out of the van and go with the patrol officer." He's like, "Oh, okay. All right. I got it. And man, well, you can see him. He's getting a little nervous because he hadn't done anything in years. So we come, like we always did back in those days, we come screaming up to the house. Doors fly open. We all run hell-bent for leather for the front door, you know, kick it in, hollering, screaming, you know, pointing guns and screaming at everybody. That was our tactics, you know, just pointing guns and screaming. And so Duggar, he realizes he's got to hurry up, and he hurries to get out of the van, runs around and goes to the back of the house with this patrol officer. Patrol officer's watching the back door like he should, and he hears us screaming in there, and everything kind of gets quiet in the house, so he figures it's over. Well, he looks back there in the backyard, and there's this little storage building that the crook had that he kept stuff in. And what the crook was doing, he was back there hiding his dope when all this went down.
Oh.
And he looked and saw us pull up, and he hid behind the building. Well, Duggar's smoking his cigarette and comes walking around this building just to kind of see what all's back there. He comes face to face with a crook. He realizes he doesn't have his gun. He left it in the van. So he points his finger at him with his thumb in the air like a cowboy and Indian pistol like we used to do as kids and says, "Freeze, motherfucker." And the guy sticks his hands in the air and surrenders. The patrol officer sees what's going on, comes running over there and points his gun, a real gun, and throws him to the ground and gets him handcuffed. And then Duggar's just standing there puffing on a cigarette, you know, like this happens every day. So we come walking to the front of the house. They walk him back up to the front of the house, and we're all going, "Hey, Sarge, I guess the guy got away. The house is empty." And he said, "No, Duggar got him in the back of the house." And he we're never going to hear the end of it. And we said, "Why you say that?" And he says, "Because he took him down with his goddamn finger." He forgot his pistol.
Whole bunch of
freeze, motherfucker.
Oh man,
golly. Well, if the rest of the book is anything like that,
oh, there's a lot of stories like that.
Oh my gosh,
there's a lot of funny ones in there.
Now, how did you have guys when they looked at the book were like, "Hey, I don't know," like, were they hesitant to have some of this stuff, or were they all like good hearted about it and stuff?
Yeah, everybody's been really good hearted about it. I some of the stories are changed. I changed everybody's name. Yeah. And even some of the stories I took some liberties with just to make it fit the storyline a little better. So, and then, you know how it is, you know, 30, 40 years ago, everybody has a little different recollection of how things actually happen.
Right.
But, you know, generally, that's how it happened.
Yeah.
And So, yeah, but I've had nothing but great comments. Most guys that are in the book have wrote me up and said, man, I love that book.
Yeah, I bet. I bet that's funny.
Anybody called you and said, man, you fucked that up. I didn't do that.
Not yet, but I'm sure some have said that, but they just didn't call me. Probably just because they can't find my number.
That's good.
Hey, so how'd you get involved with Safariland?
I was actually instructing for them the last 8 years of my career as a team leader over Houston SWAT. And Paul Ford got me that gig. And
so it sounds like you owe everything to Paul Ford.
I do. Yeah. I owe everything to Paul Ford. And I always told him, I said, all right, so you become a Safariland instructor. I become a Safariland instructor. You retire from Austin PD. I retire from Austin PD. You go to work for Safariland. I go to work for Safariland. You leave CTS. No, I'm not going to go do that. I'm going to stay with Safariland. So anyway, that's where I drew the line. But nothing against CTS. They're a good company. But anyway, I just decided to stay with Safariland. But yeah, I've followed in his footprints, and I owe him a lot for what he's done for me. But so anyway, I'm an instructor, and toward the end of my career, the big bosses up there, I guess they had noticed me or somebody saw me or whatever and said, hey, you thinking about retiring? I was like, no, not really. He said, well, you're getting kind of older. You know, you want to come to work for us, we might have a full-time gig for you. And I'm thinking, I'm not that old. And then I went and looked in the mirror and went, holy shit, I am old. So I called them up and I said, hey, let's talk. And they made me one of those offers I couldn't refuse. And I left HPD on a Friday, went to work for them on a Monday and never looked back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what age did you retire at? How old were you?
I was 50, what was it, 50, 50, 51? Yeah, okay. 50. Yeah.
So you were still, I mean, 50, young.
I was still relatively young. Yeah, I knew I couldn't retire and just do nothing. Yeah. I couldn't afford that. Yeah. So, I was either going to stay with HPD or get another job, and I couldn't think of anything I'd rather do, except I got to stay in the law enforcement industry, which was great, mm-hmm. and I got to travel around the state. And at the time, they said, you got to go to sales. I wanted to go to training, and they said, no, there's not an opening. You got to go to sales. So, but I was traveling all over South Texas, and I had a company credit card. And you know, when the Safariland rep comes in, I'm going to take you to lunch. Uh-huh. Hey, you need a holster? You need this? You need that? I was giving stuff away and taking my buddies out to eat. It was a great gig.
Yeah.
I loved it. and then they said, hey, there's this regional director position open for the Western United States. You want that? And I'm thinking, well, how much does it pay? And they told me. I went, okay, yeah, I'll take it.
I'll do that.
Yeah. Well, then I didn't like it because now I'm just getting on a plane. And then it's just business. I'm not dealing with cops anymore. Now I'm dealing with distributors and getting screamed at because of things that are going wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm having to fire people that aren't doing their job. And I didn't like that. I was thinking about, hey, I'll give this up. Just put me back out in sales. But then Mike Finley left. He was the director of training for Safariland. He left to go to the mothership, which at that time was BAE Systems.
Okay.
Yeah. And that left the director position open. And I said, now that'll take that job. And I applied for that and got it. Never looked back.
Cool.
Good for you.
Yeah.
So when you retired from the game, was it difficult?
No, not really. It really wasn't because I was staying in the industry. Mm-hmm. If I would have just retired, it would have been difficult. I tell you, the most... I wanted to take that pager. That's all we had back in the day. Now you guys got cell phones. But I wanted to drive over the Ship Channel Bridge and throw that son of a bitch in the water. But obviously I didn't. But the greatest feeling was that first day I retired when I drove into my driveway and I realized I'm not going anywhere tonight.
Yeah.
I can park my car any way I want to and I can do what I want to. I don't have to leave tonight.
Yeah.
Because every other night, you always had to, hey, nobody blocked me in. I got to stay ready to go, and I keep my stuff ready because, you know, you got to jump in and go.
Like you had to miss it just a little bit, right?
I missed it when I'd see call-ups on TV, and I'd see the guys, and I'd go, damn, I wonder what. And so the next thing you do, I'm calling them, what happened? What happened? You know, but I didn't miss the day-to-day and the you know, just the bad things that go with
what
the job.
What was the op tempo back then when you left?
We were running probably around 35 to 40, 45 SWAT situations a month. That's true SWAT situation, not warrants. And then probably about 30 narcotic search warrants a month. So it was staying pretty busy.
Yeah.
Probably out of those SWAT ops, maybe two or three would be a hostage situation, maybe, you know, and then you'd have that quasi hostage situation where, you know, yeah, she's in there, but she could probably leave anytime she wants to.
He's passing out drunk. And,
She's afraid we're going to kill him if she leaves, you know. And one of the funny stories in there, we're trying to get this guy to come out, and he's going, no, you're going to kill me. And the negotiator's going, we're not going to kill you. Just come on out. And no, you're going to kill me. And this goes on for a while. And finally, the negotiator becomes so frustrated. He says, why do you think that we're going to kill you. And he says, because before y'all got here, those patrol officers I was talking to, they said, okay, asshole, now you screwed up.
SWAT's coming.
SWAT's coming, and they're going to kill you.
How big was the team? How big was the team back then?
As far as I know, it's still the same size. It's 24 operators, and then three sergeants and a lieutenant.
I think Marco said something about that. And now they
have 16 part-time guys.
Yeah.
So we interviewed Marco last, and he was talking about some of that stuff. So I was wondering what the difference was. The
part-time guys, they go on a lot of the calls, and they train with them 1 week out of the month. And
do all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Houston's had a long-standing reputation with leadership within TTPOA. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had you, Gary Heath, Marco. I'm sure I'm missing some other guys.
Paul Hershey.
So there's been a lot of just legacies through that Houston chain and stuff like that. And guys are still, I mean, Gary Heath, I saw him out here with another company. And it's funny how guys just still stay around.
Yeah.
Not in a your dead weight way, but in a still productive way, whether it's a vendor, whether it's just, hey, I'm just here to help.
Well, it's what we know.
Yeah.
I mean, you get into this job and you get to SWAT and you're if you're on an active team and you're doing training and part of the association, it's what you know.
You're here because you love it, because you guys aren't getting paid and you're away from your families.
Yeah, we get paid now.
You're away from your families. You're away from extra jobs and other things you could be doing and making money. You're doing this because you love it. We love each other. It's a brotherhood, and we believe in the cause. And that's another thing I'd like to mention. When TTPOA first started, back in that time frame I was talking about, 95, 96, the only people I knew around the state were guys that had come to our school, like you were mentioning. You came to the Houston Basic School or whatever, or some schools that we did.
Yeah.
But I didn't know anything about how San Antonio operated as a SWAT team. I didn't know anything about how Austin operated as a SWAT team. I met Paul Ford through the association. Same thing with Mike Finley. I met him through there. But now, through the association, I know pretty much how everybody operates, what their manpower are. I've got people and phone numbers that I can call up and say, hey, we're about to do this thing. Have you guys ever come up against something like this? And we've learned so much from each other.
Oh, hell yeah.
And another group of that has really benefited is the smaller agencies, because they don't have the manpower. Yep. They don't get the repetitions that we get on real events because of the frequency that we deploy.
Yeah.
But yet they get to go to these training events and learn from people that have screwed it up big time. And that's the only reason, you know, I'd say it in the book several times, I'm just lucky. I could have and should have been shot several times.
Yeah.
I just got lucky.
No, and that's so true, because when it comes to TTPOA stuff, you start working around these folks year after year of competition and just trainings and all this kind of, and these people become another family to you.
Absolutely.
They're just a bigger SWAT family that you don't see all the time, but you still can contact, whether it's our text thread that we have, or when we have winter meetings or whatever it is. And it's like, oh man, we get to see these folks again. That's why I love the competition. You get to see other teams and you're talking with these guys. I was talking with a team last night, brand new here. And I was like, hey, how'd you do today? He's like, man, we did this wrong and this wrong. I said, hey, I saw y'all run. Just work on being efficient tomorrow. I said, you're not going to win the thing. Just be efficient.
There you go.
Take that back to your teams, and it's going to be more efficient on real ops. And I said, also, get with these teams and start talking with them. He goes, man, we already have. And they started telling us, I said, that's what it's about. That's what it should be. And then next year you're going to come back. You're like, hey, so-and-so, hey, so-and-so. And it's going to just keep building. And you need to bring your young guys in here to let them start building the reputation of knowing these guys. Hey, man, here's our gear bitch this week, and just things like that. It's a good thing. Or you get them involved in selling T-shirts for us or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it just keeps building that camaraderie. And that's huge.
Yep.
You're right. You can call anybody up in the state or even other states. I mean, I have other organizations reach out to me a lot of times, or people in other states. How is TTPOA doing this? Why are y'all doing that? How are y'all so successful?
Yep.
And I'm like, man, we just got guys that have passion and work. I don't really know. There's no formula to it. It's just do it.
One thing I'd like to add to that is within your own team, we had one of our team leaders, Gilbert Reyes. I don't know if you guys ever knew him, but he committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And he's in the book a lot. And he I talk about we all have a little box in our brain somewhere that we put away all those bad memories. Mm-hmm. And then every once in a while, you know, they one of them gets out, and you know, because we are reminded about it, or yeah. somebody asks us about it, or we see something that's relevant to that. And you have to struggle to get that story or get that memory yeah. put away. But sometimes our box comes open and, yep. and you can't get them trapped back in. And those are the guys that we need to be there for.
Yeah.
And at Houston, we started an alumni association. Mm-hmm. And it's all of the current guys are members and all of the past guys. Okay. And we went all the way back to the original team in 1974. We still have three that are alive. And every other year we get together at a dinner and we have a keynote speaker and,
oh, wow.
and it's a huge camaraderie.
That's awesome.
We have a closed Facebook page where we all post things and keep yeah. track of each other. And we all know each other's phone numbers. Oh. And when one member knows that another guy is in the hospital or his wife died or whatever, we're on the phone or just Facebooking each yeah. other, that kind of thing. And anyway, it is wow. tremendous. And every year we have the reunion, we have a commemorative thing. It's a beer mug. This year we're giving away challenge coins. And the three guys that are hopefully still here in January
yeah.
will get a special challenge coin of the original SWAT team, and everyone else will get a challenge coin. And on the back of it will be, in our team, we have radio call signs. Uh-huh. We don't use your real numbers. We yeah. use, you know, like me with Sandy, because my uh-huh. real name's Marcus, but like, you know, guys named Pinky or Flip yeah. or Hutto or whatever. Uh-huh. And that radio call sign will be on the back of his, challenge coin and his wing number. So when you come on a SWAT team and you're given your wings, there's a number on the back. And they're in sequential order from the very first SWAT wing that was given out.
Really?
So, like, mine is, I can't remember now.
Two.
Two.
You know. But anyway, they're still keeping track of those numbers. And there is a log at the office where they know that if that SWAT wing is found somewhere, they know who it was.
That's awesome.
So, anyway,
that's
cool. that will be on the back of that challenge coin. So, my point, that's just a little incentive yeah. for guys to be members, and but to keep track, because we risk our lives with each mm-hmm. other.
Yeah.
And this is more than just a job. Yeah. And after we're gone, nobody wants to be forgotten. And this is a vehicle and a way for us all to be remembered.
That's really
and
cool.
to stay in contact with each other. So if you don't have that, and we're a 501c3 membership and everything,
really cool.
and it's we can get sponsorships. And I would be happy to share with you guys what we've done and the way we did it. And I encourage you to do that.
That's really cool. That's
really neat.
We do a SWAT Christmas party every year, and everyone that's ever been on the team is always invited back. And it's cool to see
yeah.
the guys that you're like, oh, man, I know who this guy is from this story
that's
and
great.
Stuff like that. Fortunately, I've been there long enough where most of them I've worked with, and then some of them I hadn't. But the other guys that are new to the team are like, hey, man, these are the shoulders that you're standing on right there.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely.
That's neat. So Houston SWAT started in 74?
74.
74. Right. And you said you got on in
79.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So you were, one of the first guys. And
yeah. It was 24 members then, and it's always been 24 members.
I cannot believe it's not more than that.
Yeah. And the good thing about that is we have very little collateral duties. We don't go out and do any kind of patrol work.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. Because we're such a small unit that we get lost in, it's a drop in the bucket in the manpower yeah. of the city of Houston. If we were, 200 strong,
yeah.
they'd be going, hey, we need some more productivity out of you guys. That's too many guys. What are you guys doing? So, it's just the way it's always been.
So if any of our listeners, all three of them, want to buy this book, where can they get it at?
Amazon. It'd probably be the easiest, but it's sold on several of the other Apple and several of the other ones. It's sold in hardback, paperback, as well as an ebook, a Kindle kind of version.
Yeah. So on the back, it says 1999, you won the TTPOA statewide SWAT, Super SWAT
yep.
competition.
Yeah, I did. In Abilene, Texas.
Okay. So that was the single event. Super SWAT.
Right, this single guy running.
It's funny, so we had the board, and when I first started competing, that was one of the events, the Super SWAT. And then, I don't know what year, it kind of went away.
Mm-hmm.
And then this year, they brought it back as a three-man event this year and stuff like that. So in 99, you won it. All right. How many competitions did you personally compete in?
Well, we did the one in Florida SWAT roundup, and then probably five, maybe six. I can't remember for sure. Cool. As a team. Yeah. Then that one year, we were so down. I don't remember what, politics or whatever, but the team could not go to Abilene. Uh-huh. And so then I said, well, I'm taking time off and I'm going to go. And I said, well, since I'm going, I might as well just compete in the Super SWAT. And I'll be damned, I didn't win it. I think most people laughed at me when I said I was going to enter it. And I just wanted to finish. That's all I wanted to do. And I got lucky.
Do you remember the events?
Well, it started off, running up a tower and rappelling down. Then you had to run and shoot a handgun. And then you had to go through this obstacle course from hell.
Abilene. It's high.
Yeah, and it's like a mile and a half.
And snakes.
Through the woods and all this stuff. And then you came back down and you had to shoot an MP5, you had to shoot an AR-15 and shoot a shotgun. And then it's a sprint to the finish. And the only reason I won is because I strategized. I got to looking at the scoring system, and there was a tremendous amount of points taken off on shots missed. But the time, because it was such a long event, was not that hard a deal. So when I got back down from that obstacle course into the flat range area where I had to shoot the three different guns, I literally told the guy that was my spotter, George Greger, I said, I want to take a minute to just breathe. Uh-huh. Okay. I said, start when I hit there, hit the clock, tell me when a minute's up. And for a minute, I just sat there and breathed. And everybody's looking, you're going to take a shot? No, I'm going to breathe. And I got my breathing down, and then I took the shot, and I aced all three of those shots. All
that. Well, you know, that's funny, because if teams would do that now and make their hits and just run their pace, but run it clean, you're going to have teams that, you know, shoot themselves in the foot or do something weird and have misses, and you cannot outrun your misses.
No, Steve Claggett gave me one of the best advices when we were competing against them, and that's the thing. We were all friends.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
You know, on the range, I was trying to smoke that guy, but that evening I was drinking beer with him.
Yeah, exactly.
But he said our strategy is run fast, shoot slow.
Yeah.
You got to make your hits, man.
Yeah.
You have to make your hits.
And it's still like that today. I love it because, you know, Irving Garland has a big rivalry, and we're all good friends and stuff. And, you know, when they're up, it's beat Garland, and where we're up, beat Irving. And it's so fun. I mean, that's a cool deal. And I remember the very first competition I did was in Dallas, and Rick Cutler was out there, and Paul Cerami, and they're like, all right, Irving, all right, Garland, you know, and they're talking shit, and I didn't really know who they were. I'm like, man, what the hell, man? Are we going to fight with these guys or what? You know, and stuff like that. And, you know, and now they're friends of mine and stuff. Yeah. And it continues, even with their new guys and our new guys, you know, it's still like, hey, you go over there, you meet them because they're going to be your friends.
Absolutely.
You know, and stuff. Yeah. So I think that's important.
Yeah, it is.
And stuff. Well, I will tell you, anyone who's listening, who's a member of TTBOA, if you haven't met Sandy, when you meet him, you're going to enjoy him, but you need to thank him for what he's done for our organization, what he's done for the SWAT community. And truly, cause he's one of the guys that has built the foundation that is here now and today that we are taking to a new level and stuff like that. So if you're one of the new guys to TTPOA and you don't know him, introduce yourself to him and truly thank you. I mean, you deserve that. I mean, for what you did and the vision that you had.
Well, thank you. I had a lot of help, and I could not have done it without all the help I had. And it was a labor of love.
Yeah,
it really was.
Well, and that mindset that you have and the culture that you set back then, it is still today, because it's what me and Derek talk about. It's not about us. It's about these members and getting them good training and getting them contacts. And it's truly about them. It's not about us.
Absolutely.
And stuff. So,
Thank you for taking time out of your weekend coming up here and talking to us and doing this with us. And
every day's Saturday for you now, isn't it?
I forgot.
Yeah. Every day's Saturday.
If I hurry, I can get to the boat and get it launched in about 3 hours. I'll be
hell
out of the water.
Hell yeah.
You going to hang out and watch a little bit? Or are you going to go back
I'm
and
hang
go
out
boat?
A little bit.
Okay, I was fixing to say. I was like, shit, man. You come here, do this, and leave? You got to come hang out a little bit and watch some of this stuff.
Yeah.
No,
and bring back some memories.
Well, it was a pleasure and honoring just getting to do the podcast with you. And I truly thank you for what you've done for this organization myself.
Yeah. And again, check the book out, The Long Road Home by Sandy Wall on Amazon and wherever else you can. Yeah.
Wherever you buy books.
Wherever you buy books.
Will you read it to me tonight? In our hotel room? Will you read it to me?
Yeah.
Cuddle up.
Yeah. I'll cuddle up with you. I'll read the big words for you.
Hey, you know what someone told me last night?
What's that, buddy?
we were drinking some beers in the hotel.
I'm sure this is going to be rich.
They were like, "Hey, what's up with Derek, man? His arms are getting smaller and his belly's getting bigger."
Oh.
I was like, I was offended,
man.
And then another guy said the same thing, and they just wanted me to relay that to you.
They're just jealous.
So I'm just saying that.
They're just jealous of my belly.
I was just like, I don't see it, but if you see it, you know, I'm just
I thought it was going to be something way worse.
I could tell you a story that I was doing for our Uber last night. Oh my gosh, that guy, I was just talking shit. He believed everything I said. He really, it was, I told him I was Southern Canadian.
You do look kind of Southern Canadian.
Well, one of the people we had in our car, she was a rep, and she's from Minnesota, and she talked like, "Hey, Minnesota." And so she starts talking, and he goes, "Oh, you're from Canada." She goes, "Yeah, I'm from Canada." And I said, "Yeah, I'm from Southern Canada." He goes, "Oh, that's really cool. I've never met anybody from Southern Canada." I'm like, "Yeah."
You have now.
Yeah, I said, "Where are you from?" He goes, "Texas." I go, "Oh, man, yeah, you really have a strong accent." He goes, "Well, I don't know about that." You know, I said, "No, you have a strong accent to me." I said, "You're kind of like a Southern Canadian." And he's like, "Man, like, where are you from?" I'm like, "I don't know, Saskatchewan. I don't know Canada." And so then he's like, "So you're here for the convention?" We're like, "Yeah, we're here for the convention." He goes, "What is it about?" I said, "It's a adult entertainment toys." He's like, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "We're actually coming out with a new model of sex toys." I said, "Are you into that?" He's like, "Well, I might be." I was like, "We have a new product. It's latex, but it's also, you know, I'm doing all these like hypoallergenic and stuff like that." I said, "Also, we're looking at," I said, "Hey, are you into like pregnant girls?" I said, "Because we're looking at doing a pregnant girl model, and you know, how much hair do you like?" And this, and dude, I'm just bullshit. And just he's like, "You got a card?" I was like, "Man, actually, I don't have my card.
Who would want a card from you after that?"
I said, "But go on our website, pleasure." What was it? Something Sweet Pleasures or something like that. He goes, "Okay, man."
He's like, "Yeah, I know that one." Yeah.
So it's just shit like that. Whoa, 21-0. Damn.
Yeah, Texas up 21-0.
Whoa. Yeah. All right, then.
All right, guys. Well, Sandy, again, thank you for everything.
All the best, buddy.
So, hey.
Yes.
So, one more question.
Oh, yeah. That's our, yeah.
We always ask our guests, our motto is train hard, right?
Right.
So, two questions.
Where did that come from?
Yeah, two questions you.
Yeah.
Who came up with that one?
It wasn't me. Okay. I don't know. I actually came up with the first label that we gave our swag that we sold. It was called Hard Entry Gear.
I like where your mind was on that.
Yeah, somewhere along the line, they got dropped, and they came up with the other, but I can't take credit for that.
All right, so that's our motto, right? Train hard.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
To me, it means think of the mission and not yourself. Forget about pain and the things that that you don't like to do, and train on the things that you need to do and have to be prepared to do, because it's not about what you can do on any given occasion. It's day in and day out and what you can do on your worst day. Mm-hmm. And you got to train hard for that. And it's not going to come natural, and it's a perishable skill. We all know that. And it's about being ready at a moment. You know, we train for these competitions a hell of a lot harder than we do for the real thing. And it should be the other way around.
Yeah.
Because our very lives and the lives of those that we're entrusted to protect, mm-hmm. and go in, because we know what can happen if we're not at our best. And that we ought to be training every day for that. Yep. And that's where it really should be. It should, yeah, it absolutely. Should be, it should be about a competition every day.
I like that.
I do too. That's like awesome. That. Again, Sandy, thank you for everything.
Yes, sir.
Brandon, you got anything?
No, I'm pretty
Sandy,
much out.
You got anything else?
No, sir.
All right, guys.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Stay safe. Train hard.
Train hard.
Train hard.